Hello and welcome to the As Yet Unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 26th of November 2017. My name is TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Phil from the West End Whingers, Gareth James, Paul in London, and Johnny Fox. We're now going to talk about Network at the Littleton Theatre, part of the National Theatre. This is an adaptation of the 1976 play written by Paddy Chayefsky and directed by Sidney Lumet, which starred Faye Dunaway, William Holden, and Peter Finch as the character Howard Beale. This production stars Bryan Cranston, who's been brought in as Howard Beale, with Michelle Dockery as Diana Christensen, the young Network producer who takes him under her wing after he declares, first of all, that he wants to kill himself on air after he's been fired, and then after he is unfired and has a bit of a rant in which he says, "I'm mad as hell and I can't take it anymore," and encourages everybody else to say that, he becomes a media celebrity. And also we have Douglas Henshall as Max Schumacher, who is Howard Beale's oldest friend, who gets involved with Diana Christensen. Other members of the cast include Richard Cordery, Charles Babalola, Caroline Faber, Michael Elwin, Robert Gilbert, Tom Hodgkins, Tunji Kasim, Evan Milton, Patrick Politi, Danny Sam, Paxi Vernon, Toby Bamteffa, Isabel Della Porta, Ian Drysdale, Andrew Lewis, Beverly Longhurst, Stuart Nunn, and Rebecca Omog-Behin. It's directed by Ivo van Hove and is designed by his long-term designer and collaborator, Jan Versveefeld. We've also got video designed by Tal Yarden. The play here is based almost entirely in a television studio, which they've built onto the stage at the Littleton. We also have a restaurant. I think you can buy seats to eat in the restaurant, and I think it is actually a real restaurant by the looks of things, along the side where, when they need to set scenes in various restaurants, they can do. But mainly we are in the television studio. We have cameras on there, a large video screen so that individual pieces of detail, if you miss them, they can be put up on that screen, and also they can do one or two video tricks, although I believe the exterior shots are done live every night, so you can go and yell at people, which I think it has happened on one or two occasions when a couple of the actors are walking into the theatre from outside. Phil, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
When you walk into the theatre and you see it all happening on the stage, because the Littleton is an absolutely massive stage, it looks incredible. I was very impressed. It is a real restaurant. It's about £85-95, I think, to have a three-course meal. You can have Portland crabs and various other things. There's also a bar just behind it, a real working bar, which you can pay to sit out and have drinks at. That's kind of quite hidden, certainly from where we were sitting. And for 10 minutes, it was quite a sensational. I thought, wow, this is kind of something really very different. But after a bit, when I realised how much that was going to dominate the whole production, it became incredibly annoying and irritating watching key scenes. And even from a great seat, fairly central in row E of the stalls of the Littleton, having to watch things on screens because of bad blocking, people filming were in front of the actors. You were forced to sometimes watch on scenes. In fact, very early on, when Howard Beale Cranston is told that he's going to lose his job, he's sitting at the bar and I could not see him at all, so I had to watch it on the screen. And this happened throughout the show. Also, the sound, and I'm told it wasn't just because we were at preview, it's still out of sync. It's massively out of sync, so it's very annoying watching it on the screen. I found the gimmick absolutely killed the story. Yes, it's very prescient. My idea of why he had the restaurant on the stage was because when we watch TV, we eat and we drink and we don't really fully concentrate. I sort of wrote that as a joke about it, but actually that is the real thinking behind it. And it's a completely unnecessary gimmick. Watching people, there's a scene when Michelle Dockery's character and the guy that she's having an affair with come from their street walk, which you watch on film, and then they join the restaurant, they sit and then they have sex at one of the tables. I found myself watching the diners around them, the audience members' faces, reacting to that rather than watching the thing. And I think probably all that's slightly the point, but it's a very, very annoying gimmick, I felt. So really, it actually ruined it for me. I do think Bryan Cranston's performance is absolutely fantastic. It's just a shame that some of it is getting lost and you find you're watching it on film. Well, it's already been done as a film. I'd rather see a stage production that I can actually watch. It's set in the 70s. The technology is very modern, which kind of throws the whole thing. It's a very sort of 70s story, but it is way ahead of its time. It was way ahead of its time. You know, it kind of predicted Trump in a sense. It predicted reality television with the interaction from audiences. It's a very, very clever piece of writing, but I think lost in this very, very busy production.
Well, I'm more positive about it than Phil, and I think on this occasion it could well be sitting further back, actually, because I was sitting significantly further back in the stores on the opposite side, although central-ish, to the restaurant. And even though the noise of the knives and forks irritated me, and even though I'm not entirely convinced by the idea, it didn't bother me as much, if you see what I mean. And I thought, because the whole film is about TV and about being in a TV studio, I thought the idea of the live footage for once, because it is a trademark of Van Hove's work, worked very well, because I think it kind of emphasized, you know, this was really all about a new studio, and, you know, we had the control room and the makeup room and the meeting room in addition to the restaurant. And I thought that doing that and having the live footage kind of anchored it in its TV studio setting. So that sort of worked better for me, I guess. I was surprised when I realised that Lee Hall had decided to leave it in the 70s, although at the end of the play, I can see why he left it in the 70s. I think it would actually be quite difficult to move, because if you moved it, you'd then have to think about, well, you know, we've got social media now, we've got the internet now, and this, of course, was when we got almost everything from TV. This is when TV sort of fed us just about everything in the 70s. So I guess to move it would have been quite difficult to do. And I found, I mean, I agree with Phil. I mean, it's very prescient. I mean, it does predict reality television, and it does, you know, it does resonate very much now. And I thought it still had a timeliness about it in this fake news world and this world that's full of disaffection, perhaps. I thought Cranston was terrific. I mean, he hasn't done that much stage work, and he only made his Broadway debut a few years back. So he is known for his small screen and big screen work. And I thought he's got incredible presence. And I don't think he tried to be Peter Finch, but I think he was as good as Peter Finch was on film on stage. Even though I think there aren't that many big parts in the show, but I did like Douglas Henshaw, as he likes to call himself now, as his friend and protector. And I thought Michelle Dockery was actually very good as this sort of bright young thing producer. And I also liked Tunji Kasim, who is the company CEO. So he's the sort of the adversary in many ways, really. Of late, I've been tiring of Van Hove, you know, having sort of really, really liked stuff at the beginning. The last three shows, Lazarus, which I didn't like, and Obsession, which I thought was just okay, and Hedda Gabler, which I thought was just okay. I think, I mean, he's kind of, for me, been stealing from himself. He's been plagiarizing himself. And instead of being an inventive director, I found him basically just reinventing himself a lot. But I think with this, even though there are a lot of trademarks here, he's kind of redeemed himself for me quite a bit here. And I think maybe because he's got a piece of work where he's got an adapter and a playwright and so on. So I was sort of pleased, because I'd been disappointed by the last few things, really. Just a sort of final footnote. The night I went, which was last Thursday, about 3 nights after the opening night, which was a Four House, there was an extraordinary spontaneous standing ovation. And then after the curtain call, they show video footage. And I won't tell you exactly what the video footage is, because that spoils it. But as the audience are leaving, there's video footage on stage, which is historical video footage. And this was soliciting sort of cheers and boos from the audience. So I don't think it was just them being funny about it. But right at the end of it, in a sort of art imitates life moment, there were a few people in the audience that just actually cried out the sort of the signature line from the show, really. You know, I'm as mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore. Which was a sort of rather fun and rather delicious ending to the evening as I was walking out of the auditorium. So I think it works well as a stage adaptation. I was very glad I went. I was particularly glad, even though I'm not a Breaking Bad fan, to have seen Bryan Cranston, because I think he is very, very good indeed. Paul, what did you think?
Well, I'd have to tend to agree with you, actually. I did think this worked well as a stage piece, and not just a stage piece, really. It's an event piece, not just because it's a timely production, but also you know, you've got Bryan Cranston in it, and he delivers such a terrific performance and really fills the stage and fills the screen in this. I'd also say, though, that I was sitting back when I saw it at its very first preview. So my observations, probably some things will have changed. I think, again, at the very first preview, the things that distracted me were the clinking of the plates and the cutlery, the heat lamps that were, he seemed to be brighter than anything else on stage as the food was being dished out. And then hilariously, because there's so much filming also going on, the audience members caught in the background eating their food just looked like rabbits, just chewing away. And I made the comment on Twitter afterwards saying, you know, future audience members should be aware that they are being filmed. So while they're chewing away at whatever course they're eating, they should be, you know, doing it with their mouths closed, perhaps. But yeah, I think sitting further back, you do get a better sense of the spectacle. Although having said that, and because the staging is, you know, things are really off to the side when they're at the bar and things like that, or, you know, they're not even on the stage, and so you're just watching them walk around the South Bank Centre and talk, it does actually mean that you will be watching the screens at various points. I think the other point too was that in the early previews, the musical underscoring did seem a little bit intrusive, which I'm assuming they may have fixed up later. But, you know, I was a huge fan of the movie. I thought it's a hilarious film, and, you know, from time to time I'll watch it, and I believe you can see it on Netflix at the moment. And I think the cuts they made to the movie does keep the story a lot simpler and a little bit more focused. The one thing I'd say, though, is we do miss the hijinks of the leftist Marxist rebels, or if they were Trotskyist rebels, I can't remember. And while I can understand why they've cut it, it does take away probably a more compelling motivation for how the closing scenes take place. And also, being such a fan of how Faye Dunaway does the role, Michelle Dockery in the role, wasn't quite as convinced by her scheming and her manipulation so much, although, you know, she does an admirable job in the role. And I wasn't also convinced that the TV producer's wife, Max Schumacher's wife, who's Max is played by Douglas Henshaw here, I'm not sure if Carolyn Faber was used to her best potential as the suffering wife in the piece, and how that all fit together in this, you know, bigger piece to tell about television, reality, news, and so forth. But, you know, ultimately the production is amazing. I think I want to have a countdown clock at home just so I can keep to time. I think that was just the most amazing thing to be, you know, just watching how various parts of the stage just came to life. And my other thing would say, you know, the mad as hell moment. It was funny to see that, you know, people, they used footage of people live tweeting, filming themselves, though mad as hell. But, you know, one of the things I would have liked to have seen was actually making the audience members stand up. It might have been an appropriate point, because actually that would have been where you would have usually put an interval, and, you know, it would have given the chance for some of those audience members to stretch their legs. And maybe one of the reasons they're mad as hell is because they couldn't go to the bathroom. But, you know, ultimately this was a terrific show, and I actually really liked it.
I was reflecting on how technology has moved on Thursday, because whilst this was happening in the Littleton, and it's probably technologically one of the most complex things the National's ever done, they were screening Follies to the World from the Olivier. I thought that was just amazing. In one auditorium, all the vans were outside, and they were sending this music all around the world. And then the other auditorium, we had this incredibly high-tech production with a completely functioning restaurant and kitchen on stage.
To see if they put this on NT Live, and how, you know, how much more cameras will.
It's actually
this is coming. There'll be cameras filming cameras.
Yes,
that's going to be weird. I looked to see if they were doing a live version of it, but I couldn't see a date for it.
No, I think I thought I'd seen a date somewhere.
I hear the Follies one didn't go very well, apparently, because there was problems with the sound, and some places lost 45 minutes of the sound, and when it did come back, it was quite quiet, and they had subtitles or something like that. That's what...
Oh, my God. There's me boasting about the technological marvel that's now to discover it wasn't a technological marvel at all.
Yeah, I do agree. I forgot about that, annoying the background music was in Network, and also the... I'd forgotten about the clinking of the cutlery and the plates.
Rabbit-like eating, I think, was more funny for me, actually, sitting there watching someone chew with their mouth open was...
To be honest, I would never go and sit in the restaurant and eat a meal. I mean, apart from sort of wanting to be seen by people, I can't imagine why on earth you'd want to do it, really.
Experience. Although, having looked at the menu, which seems to be a lot of squash and kale and polenta,
I saw
And everyone, you've got a choice of gin and tonic sorbet or Black Forest Gâteau. It's like, oh God.
Or a Madder's Hell cocktail.
Is this menu from the 70s?
I assume that the waiters don't come around and ask you, is everything all right? Because it would be rather distracting.
Yeah, that's when the audience members should stand up saying, no, I'm as mad as hell. I paid this money for, for a crap meal.
What happened to meal?
Now you give me an idea now. Now I am going to buy a ticket for the restaurant.
I kind of want to see it from the stage just so I can get
I am going to go along. And I am going to shout mad as hell from my table, yes. Tim, we haven't heard what you think.
I do like the spectacle, and I think it's extremely well done. I mean, obviously there are the problems of the sinking and the... I wasn't quite so aware of the cutlery, and I could pretty much see everything apart from the backstage area where they were getting the makeup put on. But I did have some problems. There's something that Paul said about Caroline Faber. She is a bit underwritten in this production. And also, I thought Richard Cordery, who is... the man who comes on, I mean, he is the head honcho of whatever the multinational is that has taken over the company. And he is supposed to convert Howard Beale over to his idea of thinking. And he comes in almost like a Deus Ex Machina. I mean, he is up on a platform above the stage and almost preaching. And it's almost as if he appears as a character out of nowhere and... utterly convinces Howard Beale in a speech which I didn't find convincing at all. And it gave me a few problems with that. And I think that this is a slight problem I had with the production as a whole, is that some of the minor roles are were very, very underwritten. And we were really concentrating on your big three, you know, Michelle Dockery, Douglas Henschel, and Bryan Cranston. And that's okay. Nobody's going to worry about that. But you really wanted a little bit more written character from them, I think. And we didn't really get it. And I would be curious to go back and look at the movie and see what the original was like and whether or not we get more convinced by certainly the character of the wife and the character of the CEO, the chairman of the board.
Definitely the character of the wife. Yeah, she is much more written out in the movie. But Arthur Jensen, who's the role played by Richard Cordery, he is meant to be the voice of God. I think the way they staged it, you don't get that sense. I think, Phil, you were going to say something too.
No, I was going to say about the role of the wife in the film, who's played by Beatrice Stray. She won an Oscar, Best Supporting Actress Oscar, and it is apparently the shortest screen time that anybody has ever won an Oscar for. And I remember when I saw the film when it first came out, I remember thinking, God, she got an Oscar for that, because she's only in it for sort of about 5 minutes, a bit like in the play. So I think she has quite an impact, I think, in the film, but she had no impact at all in the stage production, because it's kind of lost on that massive stage anyway, to have sort of that intimate kind of scene and then all that business going on around it.
Yeah.
There was me thinking Judy Dench's Queen Victoria in Shakespeare in Love was the shortest performance by
Probably not. Well, it was the shortest one until 2016. I don't think there's been any since. Topped it or under topped it.
We're now going to talk about Glengarry Glen Ross, which is on at the Playhouse Theatre. This is David Mamet's 1983 play, which was later made into a movie, also scripted by David Mamet in 1992, which starred Jack Lemmon and Al Pacino. This production stars Christian Slater, Robert Glenister, Chris Marshall, Stanley Townsend, Don Warrington, and Daniel Ryan, with also Oliver Ryan as well playing detective. It concerns a group of salesmen who are trying to sell land. They're trying to sell land in Glengarry Highlands, and they used to be selling lands at Glenross Farms. This is real estate in, I believe, Florida, and if you've ever read any Carl Hyerson, he's got a very low opinion of property speculators in Florida, and people who buy land are always being ripped off. So this is probably a fairly dodgy operation. It's run out of Chicago. And what people are most concerned about, this group of salesmen, they are most concerned about getting good leads. A lead being a person, the phone number at this time. We're talking about the late 70s, early 80s when this is set. And they're looking for basically the phone numbers of somebody or the address of somebody who they can go and knock on the door and say, would you like to buy some land in Florida? Either Glengarry or Glen Ross. And We start in a Chinese restaurant where Shelley the Machine Levine is trying to convince the office manager, John Williamson, to let him have better leads. He's got terrible leads and he wants to get on the good list, and only certain people have the good list. We then switch to a different scene. It's still in the same Chinese restaurant, but this time Dave Moss is trying to convince his friend George Aronow to steal all the leads from the office they both work at, because Dave Moss is going to work somewhere else. And then finally, in the first part of this play, we are still in the Chinese restaurant, but this time it's the Ricky Roma, who is the star salesman, and he is trying to bring a man called James Link into buying land and is about to clinch the deal, and it looks as if he does. And really what these salesmen are being threatened with is that if they don't make better sales, they're going to get canned. The ones who do the worst are simply going to get fired. So they're all a little bit worried about their job, especially Shelley Levine, who has been unable to get decent leads and therefore wants them. In the second half, we switch back to the offices they work out of, and the offices have been robbed, presumably by somebody connected to Dave Moss, who seems to have disappeared. And we see the fallout of that, and we see certain changes. You know, the client doesn't want the land that Ricky Roma has sold him. Shelley Levine thinks he has made a big score. All the while, they are questioning people about these missing leads, this missing information. It's rather interesting, of course, because these days, this sort of thing has gone completely out of the window. You know, it's all on computer, and your leads are basically, you're buying somebody's Facebook history, or you're buying that and seeing what people want from that, and it's much more computerized, and you wonder if you got these salesmen coming in who can do the high pressure sales to you. But perhaps that's just because I've never been thought wealthy enough or daft enough to want to invest, you know, in land or timeshare or whatever that is. There is this, but this idea of the hard sell, the way that you're selling land, you're trying to get people to sign up for things and, you know, part with their money. And it's a fascinating look into it. Now, one of the things they pointed out is that when this play won the Pulitzer Prize in 1984, I believe it was 35 years after Arthur Miller won the same prize for Death of a Salesman. And it's sort of an interesting contrast, but it's still the same problem. And I do wonder if it could still be done now. I mean, we're all these years later, whether or not you could still do the same kind of play. And I'm not sure you could, because, as I said, it's all what the Facebook algorithm tells you or what your Google score might be that people are more concerned about.
I think it might apply in things like pyramid selling schemes or timeshare sales or something like that, where salespeople are not salaried but are entirely incentivized by commission and are in a very competitive situation, one with another. For I think if you're a timeshare salesman, you might have to go out and just stop people on the promenade in a holiday resort. But also, I do think there is a lot of targeted stuff where the company gives you some leads to go and chase up, and it's the best closers who still get the best leads. I don't think it's passed into history.
Yeah, and certainly their sales team seems to work off a lot of leads and they do a lot of schmoozing. This production stars Christian Slater as Ricky Roma. We have Robert Glenister as Dave Moss. Chris Marshall plays John Williamson. Stanley Townsend plays Shelley Levine. Don Warrington plays George Aronow. And Daniel Ryan plays James Link. And I think this production works really quite well. It's directed by Sam Yates, with a design by Kiara Stevenson. One of the things that we obviously have here is Christian Slater. Christian Slater, he's not exactly an A-list star, I don't think. I mean, I'm not sure what you would call him. He has had a recent run of success on television in a cult successful TV series called Mr. Robot, where he plays possibly the hero's father, who may also be a figment of his imagination. And he's got a lot of plaudits for that role. And he's also worked over here quite a lot. He did Swimming with the Sharks about 10, 15 years ago. And before that, he was in a fairly well-received production of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, doing his trademark Jack Nicholson impersonation. He's a very personable actor. I like him a lot as an actor, but I wouldn't rate him as one of the real greats by any stretch of the imagination. he's perfectly good. And I think he's very good in this. And he's ably joined, especially I would call out Stanley Townsend, who is somebody who can really hit up against him and is really excellent in this. And but then, you know, Stanley Townsend is almost always good in anything he does. But I did come away from this feeling that, yeah, it's a decent enough production. I haven't seen this play before. I might have seen bits of the movie and not really paid much attention to them. But as I've never seen this play, it was all kind of new to me and I quite liked it. But I couldn't help feeling that you needed somebody, a bigger hitter than Christian Slater, and possibly a bigger hitter than Christian Slater up against Christian Slater. It's not to say you should have replaced him with somebody, but it would have been nice to see him being challenged by somebody who could face up to him, who could challenge him in some way and challenge his fame. Because otherwise, you're looking at this and saying, well, yeah, he's not really that well known, is he? He's not really that famous and that great. And it rather diminishes what is, I think, a perfectly decent production of this play. But I just wish it could have been a great production of this play, really, and it's not disappointing. I thought it was well worth seeing, and I think you can still get fairly cheap tickets to it. So it's something that's interesting and well worth seeing, especially if you haven't seen this play and you want to know what all the fuss is. But you're probably going to look at it and say, well, you know, I want better people. I mean, okay, Stanley Town. I mean, the problem is that if you're going to say who are the two big roles here, you have Shelley Levine and you have Ricky Roma. Well, they're those positions are filled by really decent actors who do a really good job. So it's not like you can replace any of those. But you do feel that you want heavy hitters, and you want heavy hitters for this play. You want it to feel really American. And unfortunately, I'm not sure that it does. Now, what did you think about it, John?
Well, I agree very much with what you've said about it. I think it's an interesting landmark piece of writing. It skewers that sort of masculine greed of the mid-80s, and it does it very well. I think Mamet is perfect in capturing the rhythms of how men boast and bluster and bluff each other in business situations, in work situations. And, you know, I describe this as a first-rate play about second-rate men, because none of them is very admirable in either his motives or his methods. And in fact, you say it's about salesmen. I'm not sure whether it's about salesmen or con men, because I think that what they're selling is worthless land to gullible people. I could be wrong about that, but I don't think it's like, I don't think that they're like conventional real estate brokers who would be selling you a house or a farm or something like that across America. I think there is something slightly underhand about their business. I was very pleased to go and see this. It amused me slightly to think, oh, it's at the Playhouse and it's an American star with a vanity project. Well, it isn't really a vanity project, but it is amusing that the Playhouse has become the kind of venue of choice for American stars bringing, a vehicle over here. So, you know, Matthew Perry, Chandler from Friends, chose it last year for his self-written piece, The End of Longing. And in 2014, wasn't it? Lindsay Lohan was there in another David Mamet work in Speed the Plough, playing the role that Madonna had played once. And I thought Lindsay Lohan was perfectly fine, actually, but she got a lot of stick, if you like, for presuming to be in a proper play in a proper theatre. The play is about big swinging dicks. Does that come from Wall Street? I can't remember where the phrase comes from, but it's also, you know, like the guys in the red braces in Wall Street. It's who is the biggest hitter, and the biggest and swingiest dick for miles is Christian Slater's Ricky Roma. I think it's a spot on portrayal. You say that you don't think he's a very significant movie star, but he definitely has the edge over most of the rest of the cast here, you know, swaggering with confidence and showing how he sort of measures out his charm to the customers according to the size of the scale. And, you know, he's got the sharpest suit, he's got the sharpest lines. I think he's near perfect in the part. I saw him in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest doing, as you say, his Jack Nicholson impersonation. And in that production as well, he seemed to relish being the successful American actor in a London cast of Brits who are faking the accent. And here I think, however good a lot of them are, most of them roll over and let him have the limelight. It's only Stanley Townsend as Shelley Levine, who is this kind of veteran sales guy, this closer, as they like to call themselves, approaching his sell-by date. He's the one who, for me, came nearest to capturing the tenor and the rhythm and the pacing of a Mamet script, especially in the scene where he pleads with the office manager to give him better leads, give him better clients, which is an interesting piece of acting by Chris Marshall, you know, abandoning all his mannerisms and diffidence that you know and like him for in things like Death in Paradise. But it's the Kevin Spacey part from the movie, isn't it? I just connected that. So I think that's an interesting role as well. But Stanley Townsend is definitely the best thing apart from Slater in the production. There's a glorious scene in the second act when he arrives in an office which is really kind of devastated by an incident which has occurred. And he's just so blissfully unaware of what's going around him that he just boasts of this fantastic sale. He's made his first really good sale in a very long time. I don't think he realizes that the office has been trashed. Now, the comparison with Death of a Salesman is interesting. I don't really see the same kind of tragic hero at the center of the piece as you get with Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. Willie has come to the end of the road and has been sidelined by the young business owner who no longer respects him as the man's father did when he set up the firm. But really, Willie is no longer able to sell whatever it is he has in that suitcase. These guys still can, I think. So I think there is a slight difference. But of course, what it does connect is the idea that, yeah, you know, 30 or 35 years apart, Miller and Mamet both have universal themes of ambition, of failure, and the long-promised collapse of the American dream. And it's interesting that it really is still relevant 35 years after Death of a Salesman, and probably, are we now another 35 years further on? I can't quite work out the arithmetic, but 25 years further on, maybe. I think you could write this sort of play. I think Richard Bean or somebody could write this sort of play about some kind of pyramid selling scheme or sales program in the UK, and maybe now it's the way people call you up from an Indian call center and try and sell you something. It's just done in a different way, but it's still desperate people who have to get their foot in your door in order to sell something that really you wouldn't buy unless you were being leveraged. So I really think this is a worthy thing to see. I only gave it 3 stars because I saw quite a shaky performance, but that's possibly because Robert Glenister has been replaced by, first of all, an understudy when he was taken ill on stage, and now I think the guy has more or less taken over the role because I guess Glenister may not come back. And I think the cast was struggling to accommodate his newness with the lines, particularly Don Warrington, who has a one-to-one scene with him in the first act. And Warrington really didn't seem to me the quality of actor that I expected him to be. I think he was thrown by the cast change. But yeah, as you say, Tim, I think there are a lot of discounts and offers around. There are day seats. And yes, it would be good to pick up an expensive ticket and go and see this. It's a nice, tight show.
We're now going to talk about The Busy World is Hushed at the Finborough Theatre. It's just closed. It's by Keith Boonin, who wrote it in 2006, and this is the European premiere. It's directed by Paul Higgins, designed by Marco Tursic, and stars Michael James, Matteo Oxley and Kasia Pelka. It concerns a woman called Hannah. She is a widowed minister. She's an Episcopalian. We are in America. She is a Bible scholar, and she has discovered or acquired a document, a newly discovered manuscript, which may be a lost gospel. There are many, as we discover. She is estranged from her gay son, Thomas, who is a bit of a traveller and has been very affected by the death of his father some years ago. Hannah hires a young writer, Brandt, to help her in the translation of this new gospel, of this rediscovered gospel, and somehow brings both young men together when her son comes back. Paul, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Who would have thought that a lost gospel would bring two men together? But that's somewhat cheekily, I'll suggest, is the premise here. But actually, this is an interesting play because, for me, what strikes me this year so far, well, we're almost at the end of it, this year's season at the Finborough, there's been a lot of these family plays and relationships about the family. And, you know, depending on whether or not the subject matter has changed a lot, but there's always this common theme about bringing families together that struck me about some of the new writing that's been presented at the Finborough. And this is no exception. essentially what this boils down to is a family drama that just so happens to be taking place with a mother who's a widowed minister and a Bible scholar, and you know, she's enlisted the help of a writer to help ghostwrite her research and put it into a publication. But all of that is by the by, because actually what's the real drama is that the mother and her son have become estranged, because when she lost her husband, it seemed there was a lot of unknowns and the son actually wanted to find that out. And I think what really actually brings out, when you go to this piece, there's probably not much that happens in the play that actually isn't surprising. So when the two men get together and you realize that they're both gay, that you know what's going to happen there, that's no surprise. But actually it's the characterizations and also the acting here that just actually brings out the material in such an interesting way. I think as Thomas, the son, Michael James is this, you know, really enthusiastic, energetic, but it was also, there's quite a vulnerability about him, and that it's quite interesting performance in that respect, because he manages to create this full character that's not just one thing or the other. And Matteo Oxley, who we saw in, if anyone caught Angels in America, he had a small role in that, you know, playing the role in as Brandt. You know, it's quite interesting as this sort of older writer, but, you know, also somewhat drifting in the world and not quite sure about where he wants to be. So you're sort of like, you've got this series of characters. I think some of the reviews for this piece actually were a little bit critical of the role of the mother, Hannah, played by actress Katia Pelka. But actually, I really enjoyed her performance. It was very, you know, sensitive and understanding, as you would expect the liberal minister and Bible scholar to be. And I think as a three-hander, this piece is quite interesting in that respect. And the title of the play, The Busy World is Hush, comes from a line from a prayer by John Henry Newman. It's about a prayer for rest at the end of the day. And actually, when you think about what this play is about, it's about, you know, all this energy and all this activity and all this enthusiasm, but actually just about what's most important is to, you know, sit back and reflect and rest at the end of the day. And actually, I think to take away from this piece is, you know, with so much going on in the busy world, in the busy lives, you know, just sit back and reflect on what's happened in your own lives and in your family. So I thought that was a very nice message. Some other nice things, yet again, it's a wonderful production. The upstairs space at the Spinborough, you know, it looks like you're in this small study in a church or a university place. And, you know, it's quite cleverly designed by Max Story. And it also doubles quite nicely for Quaint Honour, which was the other play that was running alongside this one. So, you know, I think there was a lot to admire in this piece. And, you know, yet again, it's one of Finbrough's introductions to the world of, you know, new writing and writing that you wouldn't necessarily see elsewhere in London. And I actually quite enjoyed it. And I thought it was a fascinating little story and well worth seeing. Anything else?
Yeah, I enjoyed it quite a lot. I was wanting to find fault with it early on, I have to say. You know, one or two little things, like Brandt is studying an obscure poet called Christina Rossetti. She might be obscure in America. She's not obscure in this country. We sing In the Bleak Midwinter every Christmas, and that's probably her best known poem. So people might not know that she wrote that. And of course, her brother, Dante Gabriel Rossetti, is very famous. So there is an association there. And also there's a little bit of the theology in there. I found it a little bit too Catholic. Of course, it can't be Catholic because, of course, Hannah's a woman. There's a little bit of veneration towards Mary at times, and also there's a bit of transubstantiation in there, which aren't really, I don't think, of Episcopalian beliefs, but, you know, this is minor quibble. I think it's a very well-performed role. The problem, I think, with the mother is that he hasn't really worked out, I think it's more the writing than the actual performance. I think he hasn't quite worked out who she is and properly the relationship. And I don't know that we really get to the bottom of the relationship or to the bottom of why the father appears to have taken his own life or done something like that, or why he was so unhappy, but other than depression, which may have been the clinical side of it. But I did enjoy the play overall in the end, and I found it very interesting and very informative.
Actually, I was just going to say, interestingly, because the writer Keith Brennan, he says his father's half Jewish and his mother's a lapsed Catholic, but he was baptized and confirmed as an Episcopalian. So perhaps some of the writer's own experiences are coming through this. I wasn't so bothered by some of the mysteries because actually I thought this was a deliberate choice that actually in life you won't find answers to certain things. And that's part of my thought. The play's message was you're not going to find out why this father died or why she lost her husband, but you're just going to have to get on with that. And actually, so I quite enjoyed that, some of that ambiguity. But yes, I do agree that the mother's character, particularly from starting out when you think that this is a predominant, you know, that's the main character, that she's actually really a supporting character to what the main drama is happening. But fascinating all the same.
We're now going to talk about Romantics Anonymous at the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse, part of Shakespeare's Globe. This is a production adapted by Emma Rice from a film, Les Émotifs Anonymes, written by Jean-Pierre Amaris and Philippe Blaspand. It's a French film, as you might expect. It's directed by Emma Rice with a design by Les Brotherson and has music and lyrics by Christopher Diamond and Michael Kuhlman. It's a brand new musical and features Mark Antolin and Carly Borden. They are joined by Philip Cox, Joe Evans, Natasha Jatilecki, Dominic Marsh, Joanna Riding, Lauren Samuels and Gareth Snook. Gareth, tell me more about this musical and what you thought of it.
Well, as you say, Emma Rice has adapted the film herself, and she's partnered with these two American music/lyrics partners, Michael Kuhlman and Christopher Dimond, who are new to me and I think new to the UK. And they've actually done a lovely job of producing songs that suit the subject matter. You know, the match between the style of the music and this kind of French film that only the French seem to be able to do these days, it was actually a French-Belgian film, is superb. And it sits very, very beautifully in the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse, which doesn't need much of a design for it. Although what Les Brotherson has done here is he's added some neon signs, which signpost locations, and the signs, in fact, become a bit of a running joke themselves, really. The film is actually not that old. It's 2010, and it's the story of a desperately shy chocolatier called Jean René, who's inherited a business from his dad, a very ailing business from his dad. And Angélique, who is the actual secret ingredient, perhaps, of the competing chocolatier, is called Mercier. So Angélique loses her job because her employer dies. She's incredibly shy, so she attends a kind of support group, which is what Les Émotifs Anonymes is, a shyness support group. And an employee of Jean René meets her there, discovers what she does for a living, and introduces her to her boss, who initially gives her a sales job, which is really totally unsuitable for the shy young lady. But eventually she talks herself into a job making chocolates, and then she becomes the secret ingredient of Jean René, and his business then turns around. But also, it becomes a love affair between Jean René and her, and then we see them navigating this path to true love, as it were. So it's a chamber musical. The most key thing you could say about it is that it's just unbelievably charming and incredibly romantic. It's just a delightful concoction. But those people who don't like their musical suite might not like it. And I just smiled from the minute I walked into the auditorium and engaged in French with Joanna Riding, who gave me chocolates, what more can you want, until the end of the show, really. There's even an interval song which keeps the smile on your face. And I can't imagine anyone who likes musicals, you know, how they couldn't possibly like this, really. It's what Emma Rice does best. It's actually not Mark Antolin and Carly Bowden in the lead roles. It's Dominic Marsh and Carly Bowden in the lead roles, and they're both absolutely superb. But then you've got incredible luxury casting in the ensemble, because you've got the wonderful Joanna Riding, Lauren Samuels, who's another great musicals person, and Mark Antolin, who we've mentioned. And then we've got Philip Cox and Gareth Snook, who you also mentioned, who have multiple roles in it. So it's just perfect for the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse. It's absolutely, you know, what Emma Rice does best. This is absolutely her thing. And it's a very heartwarming evening, which left me with a very warm glow. It's her last production as artistic director there. So it's nice to see that she's sort of ending on a high like this. It is running until January, I think. And I think it's, for any musical theatre lover, it's an absolute must. And I doubt whether it will be the end of it at the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse. I suspect it will either tour or transfer or whatever. But one of my evenings of the year, and I couldn't really recommend it more strongly than that.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter,
on the Azetta named London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are, ayultp.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.